Hollywood has trotted out some big guns in the last few weeks. Indiana Jones for the action crowd, Sex and the City for the Cosmo crowd. There's a movie for kids and teenagers, Kung Fu Panda. It's a cartoon. And the movie You Don't Mess with Zohan, which our critic Bob Mondello says is cartoonish. Here's Bob's take on the Zohan and the panda.
The title character in Kung Fu Panda works in a noodle shop but dearly wants to be a martial arts star. The title character in You Don't Mess with the Zohan has mastered the martial arts but dearly wants to be a hairstylist, and I'm a critic, and at this time of year, I kind of wish I could take up hang gliding. Let's start with the panda. His name is Po. He's cute, easily distracted, and perpetually hungry. If he weren't a giant panda, you'd call him a typical preteen. Not someone you'd pick to become a town-rescuing dragon warrior, but there's no predicting what ancient Chinese turtle sages will do in animated movies.
The universe has brought us the dragon warrior.
What?
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 Now, the problem is that Po doesn't know any kung fu, and in choosing him, the old turtle bypassed the Furious Five, a tigress, monkey, snake, crane, and praying mantis who are actual kung fu masters. So Po, voiced by Jack Black, has to try to impress them and his teacher.
I'm a blur.
You never seen bear style. You've only seen praying mantis.
Or monkey style. Or Comanche snickety snake.
How's that?
The other warriors are voiced by the likes of Angelina Jolie, Jackie Chan, Lucy Liu, and Seth Rogen, which is a lot of marquee talent for characters who mostly kick and punch rather than talk. But this is a story aimed at smaller tots who may not care much. For the parents who get dragged along, Dustin Hoffman waxes quirky as Poe's teacher, and the digital animators have referenced Eastern drawing styles from Chinese screens to Japanese anime to enliven the look of the film. And if the message of Kung Fu Panda, that you have to believe in yourself, is one that even little kids will have heard before, it's one that bears repeating. No pandering there. I could go on, but maybe I shouldn't. You Don't Mess with the Zohan goes on, man does it go on, for close to 2 hours, and if you're not a diehard Adam Sandler fan, I don't think the fact that it springboards off Israeli-Palestinian tensions is going to make it feel any shorter. Sandler's Zohan is an Israeli agent who fakes his own death so he can quit bullet dodging in the Middle East and take up hairdressing in New York. This new profession's cadences do not come naturally to him, as he proves in a hair salon that specializes in kids.
Young man, you know, you shouldn't jump around when this nice woman's holding a sharp pair of scissors. If you move, she could slip and slice your jugular vein on accident. There's no way to stitch the jugular. All of your blood will be on the floor in 4 minutes. I've seen this. I've done this. You don't want this.
Now, how long would you guess it takes that accent to get old? You just heard 20 seconds worth. Imagine an hour and 53 minutes, combined with slapstick and way too many Fagala jokes from the guys who brought you, I now pronounce you, Chuck and Larry. The film is cartoonish enough that it's probably pointless to get too worked up over offensive stereotyping. What's more annoying than the crassness is the film's sloppiness. Sandler's not a bad actor when he's asked to be, but here he co-wrote and co-produced. And sure, it would be nice if there was someone on the set to say, gee, guy, this could be smarter if you tried a little. But I'm guessing that when he's in his groove, you don't mess with the Sandler. I'm Bob Mondello.
She got her start on the soap opera As the World Turns, but Julianne Moore is famous for her roles, often edgy roles, in independent films like Shortcuts, Safe, The Big Lebowski, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Far From Heaven, and I'm Not There. She made her film debut in the 1992 thriller The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. In 2003, she received 2 Oscar nominations, one for her performance in The Hours, the other for Far From Heaven. Now she's starring in the new film Savage Grace, which was adapted from the nonfiction book about Barbara Daly Bakeland. Bakeland entered the elite social world when she married Brooks Bakeland, the heir to the Bakelite plastics fortune. But when their marriage fell apart, so did her life and her son's life. This is a story of social climbing, jealousy, incest, and madness. Here's a scene from early in the film, set in Paris in 1959. The marriage has soured, and Barbara's social attentions are focused more on her son than her husband. Barbara is having lunch in the park with her son, talking about their privileged lives and comparing it to the life she was brought up in by her mother, who she refers to as Nini.
Some people's fathers, some people's mothers, they have to go to an office or a factory or a store, I guess, every day. But we are fortunate. Because what we do is what we love. What does Francois's father do?
He works.
Well, we worked. I mean, father worked. Nini worked. There was no other way. I kind of had to raise myself, and then I worked too, at Filene's. And then when I could, I left. I just left. Nini wanted what was best for me, only what was best for me. Find the man, she'd say. She meant man, I guess, and she meant money. The rich, they don't have pet names for money.
Julianne Moore, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let me
Thank you for having me.
describe Barbara Bakeland, the character that you play, who was a real person. What's your take on her?
Well, she was from the wrong side of the track, so to speak, you know, in terms of these society people. She came from Boston with her mother. She came to New York City to kind of to marry somebody, to find a rich husband. You know, she dated lots of sort of society people, and then went to Hollywood for a screen test, where interestingly enough, she discovered that she didn't want to be an actress because it was too hard. She didn't want to work. You know, she really wanted, this is somebody who definitely wanted glamour and society and fame and attention without anything underneath it. You know, I mean, I think that was probably her greatest tragedy in her life, was that it was all kind of her pursuits were sort of, you know, hollow. But it didn't make her any less human. She was also kind of passionate and alive and engaged and narcissistic and difficult. And I mean, you know, she was sort of a, people would say about Barbara, like in one breath, they'd say how she was the life of the party, but then they never wanted to have dinner with her ever again. She's that kind of person.
I think one of the interesting things about your performance is Barbara Bakeland had gone to Hollywood, you know, wanting to be an actress, and then, as you've said, just didn't want to have to do the work. But the way you play her, she's acting through her life because she's
constantly, she's
not a person who grew up in society. She's not a person born to money, but she acts like she was, and sometimes that veneer just kind of falls away, and you see the person who she really
you see
is
what's underneath. And she also doesn't, she doesn't act well either. You know, I mean, there are times, you know, she's kind of a sort of a poser. And I even tried in the performance, because the movie takes place in these little kind of these vignettes at the very beginning in the 40s. I wanted my speech to have a quality more like old movies.
Yes.
You know, more like she was copying the way she thought she should speak. By the time we get to the 70s, her speech becomes much more relaxed and more sort of the time or whatever.
Over the years, you've played a lot of characters who have their moments of breakdown, hysteria, or they're just sobbing. Have you developed different ways of sobbing depending on who your character is?
Yeah, you have to, because they're all different people. You know, one of the questions that I get a lot is, you know, how do you make yourself cry? Or do you, you know, people say, do you think of something? Do you... And I can't make myself cry. Only the character can make me cry. She has to cry, so I have to be in the place where she is, and her circumstances bring me to tears. And hopefully, the character then the crying is like her. It's not going to be like me or like some other character that I did. Or, you know, I think there's some characters, I've had some silent criers, I've had some, you know, some wailers and some sobbers and, you know, but it has to be, not to sound all touchy-feely about it, but it has to be the character who kind of presents it to me.
Have you become an observer of the different ways in which people cry or lose control?
Oh, well, you know, the interesting thing about it is it's something that we very rarely see because people don't like to do it. I was just doing a movie recently where, as usual, I had some crying, and every time I had to do it, I just kind of moan and complain, and I was like, oh, I don't want to. And the director said, why? Because you can do it, and you seem to do it so easily. I said, well, no. I said, the thing about crying is that's one of the things that we don't like to show people. We don't usually show people that. We usually try to hide it. We're always trying not to cry. So to get yourself, even to get yourself to a character, to a place where you are doing it, is a weird, you know, a weird sort of twist to it. You're in an emotional place. You have to allow it to happen because it has to happen on screen. But at the same time, everything in your body is telling you not to do it.
Let me move on to a scene from another film. This is a film directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights. Mm-hmm. It's your first film with him. And in this, you're an actress in the porn industry, and your lover and director is played by Burt Reynolds. And Mark Wahlberg plays like the new actor who arrives on the scene.
That's right.
And
is making movies
with you. Yeah, the big star who's very well endowed.
Yeah.
And so in this scene, you're a casting agent at a desk for a porn film, and Dirk Diggler, played by Mark Wahlberg, walks in to audition.
Action, Dirk.
Hello, are you John?
Yes, ma'am.
Your agency recommends you very highly.
Well, I'm a really hard worker, and if you give me a job, I won't disappoint you.
What special skills do you have?
Well, I've been in the Marines for 3 years. I just got back from a tour of duty.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And it got really hard being surrounded by all those guys all day.
How long has it been since you've had a woman?
A long time.
That's terrible.
But now I'm back, and I'm ready to pursue my acting career.
Well, as you may or may not know, this is an important film for me. If it's not a hit, I'm going to get kicked out of my apartment. My landlord's a real jerk.
Really?
I see with Julianne Moore and Mark Wahlberg from Boogie Nights. So in this scene, like you're both intentionally being really, you know, amateurish, bad actors.
Right. Right.
So what did you do to?
Well, when you're acting, basically it boils down to being as realistic as possible in a film. You want to be behaving as people do in real life, which is difficult when you're being observed. But we have, you know, we've learned how to do that. We've learned how to do that by relaxing our bodies and our voices and being connected and being in the moment and looking at somebody. And there's a way that you train yourself to be able to behave that way. Now, if you're not trained, if you're not an actor, if you're not even an instinctive actor, you're not going to know how to speak with inflection. You're not going to know how to move your body and use your voice at the same time. That's something that I do. I never move on a line. Like, I make a movement and then I say the line, which is one of the things that young, you know, people, inexperienced actors do all the time. It's hysterical. So I love that Mark has that. He has a fumble in his line. He goes, I'm a Marine and I just got back. And, you know, he corrects himself mid-line. We all do that. You know, you always start a line, stop it, start it, whatever. But in this case, you know, because they're just on this little porn movie, they just leave all the mistakes in.
You seem to place your voice higher and in a more uncertain place in that scene, too.
Yeah, I did. I put it over, like, above my, larynx, so it's not connected either. Like, when people are afraid, they can't, you know, they're on top. You know, she's, like, on top of her voice. She's not in her voice because she's not in her body. You know, she's not really present in a way.
I want to play another scene from one of your films, and this is from Far From Heaven, which was directed by Todd Haynes, who first directed you in Safe.
That's right.
And more recently, you were in his film about the many different Bob Dylans. I'm not there.
Yeah.
And Far From Heaven is an homage to the 1950s melodramas of Douglas Sirk.
Yeah.
And in a lot of those films, there's personal secrets, dark secrets, lovers kept apart by close-minded social mores of the day. And this Far From Heaven has all of that, and it's filmed in those, like, saturated colors of the 50s melodramas.
Yeah.
And in this movie, you're a suburban mother and homemaker in the 1950s, unaware that your husband is a closeted homosexual.
Right.
And you and your African-American gardener, who's played by Dennis Haysbert, who is probably best known for his role as the president on 24, you start to develop feelings toward each other and slowly fall in love. But, of course, it's pre-civil rights movement. You're married. This is a love that cannot be.
That's right.
So here's a scene. Let me play a scene where you and the Dennis Haysbert character are walking through the woods. You're looking at the beautiful flowers and the leaves, and he's looking at a bruise on your face that you got in a fight with your husband.
Oh, look. How lovely.
Did he cause that?
He didn't mean to strike me.
I'm so sorry.
No. Heaven knows we all have our troubles. I'm sure you yourself...
What?
I don't know. Ever since running into you at the exhibition, I kept wondering what it must be like to be the only one in a room. Colored or whatever it was, how that might possibly feel. I'm sure I've never...
Well, I suppose you sort of grow accustomed to it over time. I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a world, even here in Hartford, where everybody does indeed look like me. The trouble is, very few people ever leave that world.
It's a scene from Far From Heaven with my guest Julianne Moore and Dennis Haysbert. Everything in this movie is so heightened. You know, the colors, the birds in the background.
Yeah.
You're speaking like movie speech. It's not...
Yes.
It's intentionally
exactly.
Not naturalistic.
Right,
Did you go back and watch those 50s melodramas before making the film?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's so wonderful sometimes to work in a specific style because there's so much feeling it can hold. You know, you have these rules, these conventions about, you know, what all the colors are meaningful, the speech is meaningful, the way people move, you know, there's intention in absolutely every moment of it.
Now, I know you grew up in a military family. Do you move around a lot as a kid?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I went to like 9 different schools growing up. But, you know, that's not uncommon for an actor. And you find with a lot of actors, if they're not military kids, they're embassy kids or traveling salesman kids or minister's kids. Any of those had sort of itinerant upbringing seem to produce actors.
What do you think that is?
Behavior. You know, you learn very, very quickly how to change behavior from place to place. You learn that it's malleable. So who you were was determined by how you were perceived. And as a consequence, I was like, well, you know, my identity felt really, really fluid. It wasn't until I was an adult, I think, and that I think it takes a long time for any of us to really try to figure out who you are. But I mean, mine was delayed significantly by moving around.
One more question. I know you have a couple of kids who are in school.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're in school plays or not, but do you go to the school plays? I think there's something that's so endearing about watching kids act.
My son, this is unbelievable because he's 10. He's in the 4th grade. They did Macbeth the other day. It was an abridged version. It was, you know, completely, it was abridged, but they all got a part. They picked parts out of the hat, and they performed it. And the clarity was astonishing. There was a line that I heard the Lady Macbeth say that I had never really heard before, where she says, "I would have killed him myself, but he reminded me of my father." And I went, "Huh?" It's like, I didn't know she said that. And here's this little girl. And I just, like, snapped to attention. It was beautiful. It was really, really beautiful because, and especially with that kind of language, when you see them communicate to each other that way and try to tell a story, it's quite moving and really authentic.
Did you cry?
Oh, did I? Yeah, I think I probably did. It doesn't take much to make me cry when my kids do things.
Julianne Moore, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A new science fiction film is out by the writer and director of some very spooky films like The Sixth Sense. This one is called The Happening, and it also purportedly is very spooky and explores the idea about what happens when nature turns against humans. Then we really can't say for sure because we haven't seen the film yet. It is very hush-hush. We can see from the trailer that we see people collapsing dead in the streets, failed perhaps by some mysterious cause. But in the movie, interestingly enough, Mark Wahlberg plays a high school science teacher scrambling to understand the cause of this major environmental crisis and escape it. And the film opens Friday the 13th. Joining me now to talk about the new film and how it fits in with real-life environmental issues is my guest, M. Night Shyamalan, who is a director, writer, and producer of The Happening. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Science Friday, but we talk about a lot of science issues. And when we were contacted by your publicist to come on the program, we figured they must have known that. And we're very happy to have you on here because we love your work. But is there any real science? Are you delving into scientific issues and using science sleuthing at all in the film?
Yeah, I mean, what was fun about it was, I had this an idea for this movie, and I kind of wrote it out, and then I went to kind of my research people here, and I said, look, here's the idea for the movie. Is this at all possible? Could this possibly happen? And they came back with all these stacks of cases and studies and scientific information, and they went, not only is it possible, but versions of this have happened in nature a lot. And so it was a very interesting process to kind of, something that kind of, take what Michael Crichton does, take two things that are scientific, that's factual, that's happened, and then take a leap to a third thing that could happen.
So is this a film about the Earth rebelling?
Well, it could be. It could be. Basically, what happens in the movie is that there's about this couple that live in Philadelphia, and then this event happens in New York where it appears an airborne chemical toxin has been released, and people are dying in a very, very horrific fashion, and it's attributed to terrorists in its initial phases, and then it starts happening in other cities, in Boston, in Philadelphia, and all along this crescent-shaped area of the East Coast. And our couple finds themselves stuck in this area, and there's all kinds of theories about who's doing it and what's causing it, and they become less and less plausible as the event takes on the scale that it's taking on. When I started writing it, people started sending me articles because they knew what I was writing about. And one of the articles was about the bees disappearing.
Right.
And
actually
the kind of the opening scene of the movie with Mark in his classroom talking about the bees disappearing. And it's very much about what we're talking about here, the idea that, there are acts going on here that science is going to try to label. And in reality, we really don't know what happened, but we know there are forces at work that we're not aware of, and there's something greater, a shift that's happening that we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a bunch of those kind of references in the movie to oddities that are occurring in science.
In fact, we have Mark Wahlberg saying that very line in the film. Let's see if we can hear that cut.
Science will come up with some reason to put in the books, but in the end, it'll be just a theory. We will fail to acknowledge that there are forces at work beyond our understanding.
Very spooky.
There's this guy, Lovelock, who talks about
Gaia.
The Earth is a system,
Right, the Gaia principle.
Yeah, exactly. And then it will correct itself. And these are all theories that are bandied about in the movie. And, one of the things that I kind of based Mark's character on, I was reading the biography of Einstein while I was shooting that beautiful new biography that came out on Einstein. And one of the things that really struck me about Einstein's story was how he was kind of an atheist when he was younger. And then, as he worked and, got more and more into the way the world exists, the rules behind it that he was discovering, he started to become a believer again. And in a way, he saw in the gaps in science some hand at work, something, some divine hand, and he attributed it to God, And he became a believer, a devout believer in the later years. And in that same way, like Mark's character is just a high school science teacher, but he knows there's gaps in science that we keep trying to fill, but it's in those gaps that he can see something. He can hear something that's at work that's greater than us.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree with you about Einstein and God, but he did believe in some sort of God, God in all of us. But you're right about the fact that a lot of people look at the world and think there must be some sort of other being controlling it. Is that where your movie heads, in some sort of intelligent being?
Well, you know, it's more open-ended movie. You know, it's very much kind of reminiscent of the Birds. The goal was to make kind of a B science fiction movie about a subject that, you know, you have a great ride and you jump and you're scared and you're crying and you do all those things as an audience member. And then at the end, the fumes of the movie kind of leave you thinking about something a little deeper. Perhaps, like, you know, in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, it's about the paranoia of communism, or even Night of the Living Dead. You kind of have traces of the civil rights movement. And in that same case, the thing that's on our mind now is, you know, when we hear about, you know, anomalous environmental things that are happening, is this something calculated? Is there a shift that's going on? And the idea did come to me kind of driving down the highway from Philly to New York.
Why did you choose a science teacher, of all people, to be the one who discovers or is a central character?
Well, I mean, he wanted to have somebody that had enough knowledge and also a lack of knowledge, that, you know, a kind of a humbleness about the things that they knew and that they didn't know. This isn't someone who's going to save the world or come up with any answer or anything like that. This has to be somebody who knows enough to believe. You know, most of my movies are about that kind of, like, struggle to awake the belief system again in you. And Mark plays this character, Elliot Moore, who kind of is almost childlike in his belief of what he sees in science and what the implications are.
I'm reminded, you know, of scientists in various films and movies who were the investigators. Sometimes they're really sinister characters. Other times, and a film like yours that reminded me of was the original War of the Worlds, where Gene Barry played the scientist who everybody turned to and eventually figured out what was, you know, how the creatures were destroyed.
Yeah, you know, in our movie, it's like Mark's character is very much kind of a wonderful question. You know, it's ambiguous what's going on, and it kind of tweaks our guilt a little bit as you watch it. And so the kind of getting that tonality was just right. It isn't a kind of an ABC case where you find out this cure and it cures everything. It isn't that structure, isn't it? It's much more of a lingering kind of question in the air, and it kind of leaves you uneasy about the future.
So people will come out of this discussing it amongst themselves.
That's the hope, for sure. That's the hope, for sure. It's kind of like after the last scream is done, there's kind of this quiet that happens, and it sits on us, and kind of in the importance of things that, you know, that are on our mind. You know, I guess it's always about my movies are always about something I'm worried about in life.
Now, you're always known for films with a twist ending. I mean, at the ending, you know, of I See Dead People, that was a great ending. Can we expect a twist ending at the end of this film?
No, actually, you can't. You know, and I, you know, whenever I hear that, I get confused because, you know, I've made a bunch of movies that don't have twist endings, but I guess, you know, it always happens that way, right?
Well, people like Hitchcock, like, you know, you've talked about the Hitchcock and comparisons to Hitchcock.
You know, yeah, that's what I always love to say. It's like, so Hitchcock's known for twists too, right?
Right.
He did one. It's a kind of a different, it's more of a, you know, what I love about it, it's like a classic old paranoia movie. That was the goal, way, you know, to do one in its genetics, everything about it was like a simple, perfect dive off the diving board.
So it's sort of, as you say, a B-movie sort of genre.
Yeah, definitely. Like a best B-movie you've ever seen. That was the goal with the crew.
Wow, and you think people will not be disappointed with the ending? Like, even if it's not a resolved ending, they won't be disappointed with it.
I hope so. Why do you sound so cynical?
Where
are you coming from?
Well, no, I'm just saying.
You're asking the filmmaker whether he thinks the ending is going to be disappointing.
Well, I'm thought maybe I'll get a surprise. I thought I might get a surprise answer out of you. You know,
I love the ending of the movie. Kind of, you know, when it turns from entertainment to just a hair of thoughtfulness. That's what I loved about the end of Night of the Living Dead. That kind of the tragedy of it.
And there's a lesson in this film.
Well, would you think only in the thought and the subject matter of it, but mostly it's to be entertained.
Well, I wish you great luck with it, and I can't wait to take a look at it.
All right, man. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. And M. Night Shyamalan, who is a director and writer and producer of The Happening, as they say, coming to a theater near you, and what better date? It's opening on Friday the 13th.